Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. After the storm, rescue workers continue the search for Floridians trapped in their homes as the death toll rises and hundreds of thousands remain without power. Then the right to vote. The Supreme Court hears two redistricting cases with major implications for future elections and the control of Congress. And rethinking college. One university makes a major push for diversity on campus, but without considering race and gender in admissions.
Students learn more when they're going to university with students that have different experiences than they do. So having a diverse student body is really important for learning.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Nearly a week after Hurricane Ian made landfall in Florida, search and rescue teams are still on the job in southwestern Florida. More than 100 people in the state were killed in the storm and its aftermath, according to the latest count from several news organizations. And utility workers say that it will likely take until the weekend for all power to be restored. More than 400,000 customers remain without electricity tonight. William Brangham has the latest.
Days into the search and rescue efforts in ground zero of Hurricane Ian, Fort Myers, Florida, emergency officials are still sorting through the wreckage.
There's massive destruction, wood pilings that we can't actually see under, and there are voids sometimes under there. So what we do is we rely on obviously all our senses.
Rescuers are going door to door, accounting for those who decided to shelter in place and who might still be missing. As of Monday, Florida state officials said more than 1,900 people had been rescued. But at the same time, Ian's death toll is continuing to rise. In Fort Myers Beach, residents are showing up for one another.
We're helping our neighbors to get there and just overwhelming because everybody needs help. Who do you choose to help?
Some say they're worried officials will force them to evacuate.
We really don't want to leave because this is all we have left. You know, and some they're not letting the homeowners back to the beach.
The sheriff of Lee County spoke to those efforts today after other residents complained that help has been slow in coming.
It's a matter of accessing the people that need that, but we are in place and those strike teams are taking people on and off the beach. I wish I could press a button and do it all right now. It just takes time.
Crews are also working tirelessly to restore power after the beating Ian dealt to the electrical grid. Officials are hoping to have far more people powered back up by this weekend. In Cuba, where the power situation became a point of national contention, most residents had their lights back on by Monday. This after protests last week over persistent blackouts when Ian knocked power out on the entire island on September 27th.
This has been terrible. No light, no food. We lost everything in our freezer. Awful.
Protests had subsided by Sunday evening.
Okay. Stop.
Back in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis pushed back on reporters who again asked about the timing of evacuation orders in Lee County.
We should be focusing on lifting people up and stop incessantly talking and trying to cast aspersions on people that were doing the best job they could with imperfect information.
President Biden is scheduled to travel to Florida tomorrow. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
In the day's other news, Wall Street extended its rally for a second day, with each of the major stock indexes rising roughly 3%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 825 points to close at 30,316. The NASDAQ rose 361 points, and the S&P 500 added 112, its biggest day in more than 2 years. Elon Musk has again reversed course and agreed to buy Twitter after months of legal battles. Shareholders already approved the $44 billion deal, but Musk had been trying to back out. Today's decision comes just 2 weeks before a trial was set to begin that sought to compel him to follow through on the agreement. President Biden and Japan's prime minister today discussed next steps following North Korea's longest ever ballistic missile test over Japan. Japanese officials estimate the nuclear-capable missile traveled some 2,800 miles before falling into the Pacific Ocean. North Korea has test-fired about 40 missiles this year. Japan's prime minister condemned the latest provocation.
The ballistic missile firing by North Korea was an outrageous act that was absolutely impermissible. We will respond as soon as possible with the utmost vigilance. I have instructed the government to check for damage caused by falling objects, thoroughly collect and analyze information, and cooperate with related countries.
U.S. and South Korean warplanes also conducted joint military drills today off South Korea's west coast as a show of strength. Ukrainian military forces built on their current momentum in southern Ukraine today. President Volodymyr Zelensky said that they had liberated dozens of settlements this week alone, in spite of Russia's efforts to annex the area. Meanwhile, Russia's upper house rubber-stamped a plan to annex four Ukrainian regions. And Ukraine's President Zelensky signed a decree that formally rules out any direct talks with Russia on account of the illegal annexation. In Indonesia, an investigation into a deadly stampede after a soccer match found that delays in unlocking stadium gates contributed to the chaos. At least 131 people died in the crush on Saturday after police fired tear gas, hoping to control rioting fans. Hundreds panicked and tried to escape through narrow exits that could only fit two people at a time. Back in this country, a Michigan judge dismissed criminal charges against seven former state government officials linked to the Flint water crisis. They include two former health officials blamed for nine deaths from Legionnaire's disease. The ruling comes 3 months after the Michigan State Supreme Court said that a one-judge grand jury had no authority to issue the indictments. Georgia Republican Senate candidate Herschel Walker, who was a staunch abortion rights opponent, has denied a report that he paid for a girlfriend's abortion in 2009. The Daily Beast website published the story after the woman provided a payment receipt for the procedure and a get-well card from Walker. He called the accusation a, quote, flat-out lie. This year's Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded to a trio of scientists for their pioneering work in quantum information science. The recipients include American John Clauser, Alain Aspé of France, and Austrian Anton Zeilinger. Clauser said the news took him by surprise.
I had long ago given stopped holding my breath that I might actually win one. But of course, every scientist wants to win a Nobel Prize, so I don't know what else. Else to say, I'm very happy to hear get the news.
Congratulations, and their groundbreaking research has helped to pave the way for a new generation of powerfully encrypted computers and telecommunication systems. And country music icon Loretta Lynn died today at her home in Tennessee. Her music reflected pride in her humble beginnings and painted a picture of her life as a woman and mother in Appalachia with raw honesty. Lynn's biggest hits came in the 1960s and 70s with songs like Coal Miner's Daughter and You Ain't Woman Enough. Loretta Lynn was 90 years old, and we'll have more on her legacy later in the program. Still to come on the NewsHour, journalist Maggie Haberman tries to explain what drives former President Trump in her new book. Vice President Pence's former chief of staff discusses Trump's influence in the Republican Party. An investigation into abuse in women's professional soccer prompts calls for immediate change, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in one of the biggest cases of the new term. It's about the role of race in drawing congressional maps. John Yang has the story.
Judy, the specific question at issue is whether Alabama's congressional map violates what's left of the Voting Rights Act, a provision barring discriminatory practices or procedures. Lisa Desjardins starts us off with an explanation of what's at stake.
Happening in Detroit and around Atlanta, a change in political capitals like Tallahassee and cultural ones like New Orleans.
I think that there will be fewer majority-minority districts after this election cycle.
Election law expert Franita Tolson sees some red states with growing black population limiting black districts as they pass new voting laws.
You have to think about how all of these things are working together to push us towards a reality in which minority voters are unrepresented in our system. And that's definitely a problem.
In Florida, currently 4 congressional districts have majority or otherwise favor black voting populations. But the new maps cut that in half, down to 2 black-centered districts. A seat in the north that some conservatives saw as gerrymandered for blacks was erased. In North Carolina, the state's primary African-American district in the Northeast Black Belt was redrawn, and blacks are no longer the largest voting group. Other examples: Purple State Michigan will move from 2 majority black districts to none, that from population loss. But in Georgia, blacks are a third of the population and growing, and still will lose 2 majority districts. For others, it's a question of proportion. Alabama is a quarter black, Louisiana a third, but both have just 1 majority black district. Critics took those maps to the Supreme Court, which is looking at Alabama's first.
It's a case-by-case basis where you have to look at the actual facts of each situation.
Hans Van Spakovsky is the senior legal fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation. He says underneath years of complicated Supreme Court rulings, a bottom line for the right is that race can be a factor in drawing maps, but
it should be a minimal factor. What's more important is compactness, keeping political subdivisions, towns, cities, counties together.
I think that's ignoring centuries of oppression that's been systemic.
In Louisiana, Dillard University student Marissa Pittman is part of a student movement which sees current maps as part of an erosion of rights.
There are a few students who I've talked to who have just decided they will not be staying in Louisiana after they graduate due to this issue. And there are also students who see this as the final straw.
Her future and Louisiana's are both on hold, waiting for the Supreme Court to decide what could be a landmark case over Alabama, redistricting, and the politics of race in America. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
To help us unpack today's oral arguments, our regular expert on all things Supreme Court, Marcia Coyle, Chief Washington Correspondent for the National Law Journal. Marcia, you were in the courtroom today. Right off the top, Justice Elena Kagan said that as far as she was concerned, this case was a slam dunk in favor of a second majority black district and against Alabama. Let's take a listen to part of what she said.
You're looking at a state where 27% of the population is African American, but only 1 of 7 districts, where there is a long history of racial discrimination in the state.
At the time, technically, she was talking to the Alabama Solicitor General, but was that her intended audience?
Well, I think partially. I think she was really also talking to her colleagues. She had noted back in February, the Supreme Court, 5 of the 6 conservative justices, not including the Chief Justice, had voted to allow Alabama's map to go into effect for the 2022 elections, even though a 3-judge district court, which included 2 Trump appointees, had found that it likely violated the Voting Rights Act and had ordered Alabama to go back to the drawing board and could produce a map for a second district in time for the 2022 midterms. She wrote a dissent there and very sharply accused the court, really, of sending a message without briefing, oral argument, or written opinions that the law was going to change. So I think she was very much talking to the court. And also, she was pressing the Alabama lawyer by saying, you know, the 3 judges on the district court said this was an easy case. Why are we here?
And talking about sending messages, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson also seemed to be sending some messages today.
Yes, the Alabama lawyer was saying that basically his broadest argument was that redistricting should be race neutral. Race shouldn't be considered. Because when race is considered, he said, you end up with maps like his opponents produced, which were racial gerrymanders. And Alabama, he argued, had produced a race neutral map. But he also said that if he considered race, he'd be violating the 14th Amendment. But Justice Jackson said, well, you know, I've researched the Constitution. I've studied what the framers thought and what they read. And I've looked at the amendments post-Reconstruction, like the 14th, 15th Amendments. And it's very clear that they were trying to bring equality to Black Americans who had been treated unfairly, which is exactly what Section 2 is doing, she said. So the Constitution is not colorblind. And I think that was either direct or indirect message to justices like Justice Thomas, who argue consistently in almost every race case that the Constitution is colorblind.
There was also a lot of discussion today about the intent of diluting minority voting power and the effect of it. So let's take a listen to what two of the justices had to say, Justice Jackson and Justice Samuel Alito.
You have enough people who are in, you know, marginalized groups that another district is possible. People are being segregated in effect, as Justice Kagan pointed out, right? We're not talking about intent. We're talking about the effect.
Forget about intent. What are the results when you do a computer simulation that takes into account all race-neutral districting factors? This is a computer. It doesn't have any intent. The result is that you don't get the second minority, majority-minority district.
Why is that distinction so important?
Well, first of all, it appeared, as Justice Kagan pointed out earlier, that the Alabama lawyer said in his brief to the Supreme Court that she characterized it as intent is all over it. And many years ago, the Supreme Court did say you had to prove discriminatory intent in order to make a Section 2 claim. But Congress reversed that and made it very clear that you don't have to prove intentional discrimination, which, by the way, is extremely difficult to prove. Instead, Congress said you have to show a discriminatory result or a discriminatory effect of the voting practice that's being challenged. And so I think that Justice Jackson was pointing out, you know, here is what we have on the ground. We have discriminatory results. And any argument you make for intent just isn't relevant because intent is not required.
There was also, it seemed, a lot of skepticism from all sides for some of the more extreme positions that the Alabama lawyer was taking. Let's take a listen to a question posed to the Alabama lawyer by Chief Justice John Roberts.
What exactly is your submission and why your argument is not an effort to resuscitate the intent test that Congress has rejected under Section 2?
There was actually a lot of confusion about, and I don't know how serious the confusion is, but from the questions, they seemed to feel the Alabama lawyer was not really being very clear on exactly what he wanted the court to do here. What was his argument? As Justice Kagan pointed out, it seemed to be he was arguing you have to have intentional discrimination. So the Chief Justice finally, after all the questions about what are you arguing here, put it to him. What do you want? You know, what are you arguing? And so, again, the lawyer stressed, a race-neutral plan. Only consider traditional redistricting principles, eliminate race. But he also was pressed by several lawyers, several justices, for isn't there a narrower approach here? I'd say Justices Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Kavanaugh, and even the Chief Justice to a certain extent were looking for a narrower approach than no race at all. Maybe, they said, we should be focusing on one of those redistricting principles like compactness. What does this district look like? And is it shaped right, or is it one of these crazily shaped districts like a dragon or a snake? So I think several are looking for a narrower approach. I don't think that would satisfy the justices on the left. As Justice Kagan pointed out very markedly, she said the Voting Rights Act, which she called the greatest achievement of American democracy, had not fared well in this court. And she pointed to recent decisions where the court had pretty much gutted one section and narrowed the reach of Section 2 already.
Our very own Chief Justice Marcia Coyle, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
A number of news reporters have tried and are still trying to understand former President Donald Trump and his influence on our nation's politics today. The one who has undoubtedly spent more time covering him than any other is New York Times White House correspondent Maggie Haberman, who has been covering Mr. Trump since the 1990s. She's out with a new book, and I spoke with her about it this afternoon. It's titled Confidence Man, The Making of Donald Trump and the Breaking of America. Maggie Haberman, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations on the book. I know a lot of people have been waiting to see this. You are considered the reporter who goes back longer with Donald Trump than anyone else and who understands him better than any other reporter. And I want to start with, I think, the question, a question that is all about what keeps him in the news, and that is his denial of the result of the 2020 election, insisting that he actually won. Is this something he believes to be true or what? I mean, we know it is not true. How do you explain it?
It's a really good question, Judy, and thank you for having me to talk about the book. He clearly, in my reporting, and I describe this, in the first few days after the November 2020 election, he seemed aware that he had lost in his conversations with a number of aides. And then by the second week, something had just switched and he was insisting that he had won. He was telling people he wasn't going to leave. And it's very hard to know now whether he really believes this or whether it is just something he is saying. But, you know, he is one of the things he said to me in one of our interviews was that he uses repetition in interviews to beat something into, and I quote, my beautiful brain. He is very aware that if you repeat something over and over again, it can turn it into something real. And it's just hard to know how much is that versus he's convinced himself of this.
Well, we know that you've written this, he views the truth as something that's transactional. How does he see the truth? I mean, how does he take in facts? I mean, does he just create a different factual universe? I mean, how does he do this?
I don't know if you're familiar with the children's book, Harold and the Purple Crayon, but it's about a child named Harold who literally has a purple crayon and he draws a whole world at night one night. He draws buildings, he draws roads. I used that metaphor to describe him in 2017. It's obviously not benign. There's a malevolence around how he does this a lot of the time. But he treats facts as if they are things that can be either discarded or invented or created or augmented, but facts are an ongoing fluid thing with him, and this is one of the things that makes establishing a baseline of discernible truth around him so incredibly hard.
Do you think he knows what's real and what isn't?
I think sometimes he does, and I think sometimes he seems less clear. I also think he's extremely suggestible. And I think he's extremely paranoid. And so it is easy for people to convince him that something is true when it is not.
And somewhat in connection with that, there's a long list of people he's belittled, people who've been loyal to him, like Lindsey Graham, Senator Graham, Kevin McCarthy. He's called him a weakling. And again, I could name many others. We know he does this. Is there anyone in political life he truly admires?
Honestly, the first name that came to mind as you were asking that question was Richard Nixon, who's obviously not alive anymore, with whom he had a huge fascination. He mentioned Nixon unprompted in one of our interviews. But no, I think that of U.S. political leaders who are alive right now, I'm very hard-pressed to point to a single person who he really admires unless they're fighting for him. He admires autocrats in other countries, and he makes that very clear. You know, President Xi Jinping of China, he's been praising repeatedly since he left office. He was constantly looking for a relationship with him in the past, and kept it going out of office. Still, this admiration. I can't think of anyone whose behavior in typical U.S. political fashion he admires right now.
Sensitive subject, but we know there are a number of incidents that happened during his presidency that led people to say he is racist. Most recently, just in the last few days, he put out a statement about Elaine Chao, the wife of Senator Mitch McConnell. She's former transportation secretary. Do you think at his core that he is racist?
I think he has a long pattern of racist behavior going back to when he was in New York City. And we clearly saw it continue in the White House, be it attacking Elijah Cummings and Baltimore, you know, a city that is part of the United States, and Trump is supposed to be the president for all of the United States, whether he was attacking congresswomen of color, you know, whether he was getting into various, you know, condemnations or lack thereof, I should say, of white supremacists, whether he was flirting with the QAnon conspiracy theory, you know, his behavior is really what matters on this front. So, you know, what exactly is in his heart, I think, becomes irrelevant. He is behaving in a racist way.
He has called you essentially like his psychiatrist, whether you agree with that term or not. But that's what he said. I'm quoting now Mary Trump, his niece, who, among other things, said that she thinks he has what she calls narcissistic personality disorder. She goes on to talk about a fragile ego that has to be constantly fed, and so on. But my question to you is, what do you think he cares about the most, or whom? What is he, at his core, what does he care about?
I just want to go back to the psychiatrist line. He said that to me in one of our interviews, and as I write, it was meant to flatter, and it's a meaningless line. He treats everyone like they're his psychiatrists because he's working everything out in real time. What he needs is attention. I think his niece is right, and she clearly knows the family dynamic and knows him and all of these family stories very, very well, better than anyone. But I do think that he needs whatever he doesn't have, and whatever that might be in any given moment.
And finally, Maggie Haberman, you've said that he may have backed himself into a corner when it comes to whether he's going to run for president again, and for that reason, he may do it. But if he does, what do you think a second Donald Trump presidency term would look like?
I think, to quote someone who knew him years ago, who said this to me a couple of months back, a second Trump presidency would be very heavily driven by spite. Now, it would look like him. I don't believe that he learned how to be president, you know, more astutely. I don't think he figured the office out, but I do think he figured out personnel, which is often what he's focused on. And I think that the people who he would put into key jobs would be very alarming to a number of people across Washington. I think that's what a second Trump presidency would look like.
Maggie Haberman, thank you, the reporter who has known Donald Trump longer than any other. The book is Confidence Man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Former President Donald Trump's influence over the GOP still looms large, and today he ramped up his fight with the Justice Department over classified documents found by the FBI at his home in Florida, with an appeal to the Supreme Court to deny them access. Mark Short served in the Trump White House. He was later chief of staff to former Vice President Mike Pence, and he works with him now. Welcome back to the NewsHour, Mark Short.
Thanks, Judy. Great to be back.
Thank you for being here. So, we knew, and we're not surprised, but former President Trump is taking this appeal all the way to the Supreme Court to deny the Justice Department the ability to review these documents. You have said that what the FBI did is questionable. But if it's proven that the documents he had were classified, should he be held accountable in some way, or should he just be given a free pass?
Well, I think it probably depends upon the severity of the classification, Judy. I feel like it's hard to justify if he truly has significant classified information at Mar-a-Lago, just as conservatives criticized Hillary Clinton for having documents transferred onto her personal server. I think it would be hypocritical to suggest it's wrong for her and okay for President Trump. Having said that, you know, Hillary wasn't prosecuted, and I think that there are concerns about the politicization of the DOJ, and I think there were when President Trump came into office, because I think that Jim Comey at the time clearly had a political agenda. I think that they were pushing a false dossier, And Jim Comey lied to him in his very first conversation when he said that you're not a target of our investigation. So I think it's natural for conservatives to have questions about the politicization of DOJ and allow the president to carry out his legal avenues all the way to Supreme Court.
So let's talk about what you're doing now. You are continuing to work with former Vice President Pence, his organization, a nonprofit organization, Advancing American Freedom. You've said that you don't think he's going to make a decision until next year about whether he's going to run for president again. But do you think the odds are that he will?
I think he's encouraged, Judy, by traveling the country and the feedback that he gets and the candidates he's campaigning for. I think he's encouraged because he believes that there's something else he can continue to give to the American people. But I think this is a very personal decision for him and his wife, and I think that the way they've always considered every opportunity he's had, whether it's running for Congress, running for governor, serving on the ticket with Donald Trump, was to pray about it and say, are we being called to serve? Is this something we're feeling is our next step? And I think that right now, his focus is going to be on the midterms. Last night, he was in Kentucky and part of an event raising resources for five different House candidates. This week on Thursday, he'll be in New Mexico campaigning for the Republican candidate there. He's traveling the country looking to try and make sure Republicans win this midterm. That'll take care of itself sometime in the future.
And I do want to ask you about the midterms, but I also want to ask you about the January 6th committee. You have testified before them behind closed doors. Do you think there's any possibility that former Vice President Pence would do so? I mean, they've done a lot of work. You've said what the committee structure is partisan. But at the same time, we know they've turned up a lot of information, almost all of it from Republicans, from former members of the Trump administration.
I did testify under a subpoena in front of the committee, and they treated me, very respectfully, Judy. But I do think there are concerns about the partisan makeup of the committee. And I also think that there's even greater concerns from historical precedent for a vice president to testify in front of a separate branch of government in a hearing of this nature. I think that it would create a great challenge for the future, because if Vice President Pence is compelled to testify in front of a committee like this, what does that mean for future president-vice presidential relationships? How will a president trust the counsel he or she is receiving from a vice president that is going to be private? And I think that the very nature of any testimony they would want would be the very specific conversations they had, because I think the committee has all the other information they need from public records, as well as keep in mind, Vice President Pence wrote an open letter to the American people about the decisions he made on January 6th. And so it's not really a secret.
So it sounds like you're ruling it out. Okay, let's turn to the midterm elections. They are just 5 weeks away from today. In a nutshell, what do you think is going to happen?
I think it's going to be a win for Republicans, Judy. I think a pretty decisive one. I think that right now Americans are struggling with crime rising across our country. There's a situation at the border that's untenable. I think the reality is inflation continues to hurt families' pocketbooks. And we're going deeper into a recession. And so I think those are going to be the driving issues 35 days from now. And I think it's going to deliver a decisive win for Republicans. I think exactly how many, it's hard for me to predict, but I think you'll see a House majority. I think you'll see a couple more pickups in governor's races. The Senate is an open question, I think, because where we're fighting as Republicans is tougher terrain where there are Democrat incumbents that I think stand a better chance. I think that's the big question mark still.
So if the Republicans take the majority in the House, and if you have a number of these Senate races where Republicans do well, Republicans who've been endorsed by former President Trump, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Arizona, Nevada, is the Republican Party then essentially the Trump Party?
Judy, I think that President Trump still has a strong control over the party. I think he made an enormous contribution to the party during his 4 years as president. So I don't think it would be... abnormal for the president to have enormous influence. But I think it's what the future holds past the midterm election, I think, is still a great uncertainty.
Well, uncertainty, but this would be an enormous victory for him, wouldn't it? I mean, if the candidates he endorsed do well and the Senate ends up flipping Republican.
Well, I think if you go back to the primary season, I think that the president consistently was able to garner 30 to 35% for the primary candidates, whether or not that was in Ohio or Pennsylvania, multiple places where he was behind candidates running. In multi-candidate races, that was sufficient to win primaries. We'll see how that plays out in the general. I think because it's going to be a Republican tide and it's more of a referendum on Joe Biden's presidency, that those candidates will win along with other candidates. But I don't think that's conclusive as to what his influence will be moving forward.
And finally, and I know you've been asked this before, but if former President Trump does run, if he's the Republican nominee in 2024, is there any doubt that former Vice President Pence, that you would support him?
I think there's a lot of hypotheticals there and a long way to go, and I think that there'll be a lot of candidates running. I think that there's a lot to play out before those decisions are made.
So no commitment.
I think that, I think there's a lot of candidates that'll be running in the 2024 cycle. We need to let the 2022 midterms play out first.
Mark Short, thank you very much.
Judy, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Past Supreme Court rulings have allowed colleges to consider race in their admissions processes, and about 40% do. But the justices will revisit the issue later this month and could overturn years of precedent. John Yang recently visited a university that has been making a big push to improve diversity without the consideration of race or sex in the admissions process. He's back now with this report for our series, Rethinking College.
The University of California, Berkeley, accepted only about 11% of applicants for this year's freshman class, which is one of the most diverse in decades. Nearly 70% are U.S. students of color. The university is trying to boost the number of students that it defines as underrepresented. That includes African Americans, Chicanx, Latinx, Native Americans, Alaska Natives, and Pacific Islanders. They've made some progress, but diversity numbers still haven't returned to where they were in the 1990s.
In 1996, California voters approved a ballot initiative, Proposition 209. It said that race, ethnicity, and sex could not be used in hiring or admissions decisions at state institutions, including colleges and universities. The result, a dramatic drop in the number of underrepresented minority students.
Proposition 209 had a devastating impact on diversity on the Berkeley campus. Our percentages of underrepresented minority students dropped by 50%.
Carol Crist is the Berkeley chancellor. Since she joined the faculty in 1970, she says she's seen the student body go from being largely white to being more diverse and inclusive in the 1990s.
We live in a diverse world. Students learn more when they're going to school, when they're going to university, with students that have different beliefs, that have different experiences than they do. So having a diverse student body is really important for learning. Also, to be a healthy state, it's important for opportunity for every young man or woman in the state of California, that they have an equal shot at going to a place like Berkeley or UCLA or UC San Diego.
Studies have found that after the UC system could no longer consider race and ethnicity in admissions, the student body became less diverse, especially at Berkeley and UCLA, the two most selective schools. In 2018, a year after becoming chancellor, Crist launched an initiative to improve diversity. Part of it was the 2019 hiring of Olufemi Ogundele, who goes by Femi, as head of admissions.
It is critically important for us as an institution, for me in my work and in my role, to make sure that we have equitable admissions processes.
Ogundele, who previously worked on diversity in the admissions offices of other schools, including Stanford and Cornell, changed how his team judges applications.
We are evaluating applicants looking for excellence and not perfection. That means that it allows us to take a look at students in the context of where they are coming from. Everything from the curriculum that they are attempting to the extracurricular activities that are available to them in their schools. We are measuring students up against what's available to them, rather than comparing students because we recognize that the K through 12 system is not apples to apples for all the students who are going through it.
To get a better sense of applicants' backgrounds, they began using race-neutral tools, like a College Board database of socioeconomic information about their neighborhoods and academic offerings at their high schools. Ogundele also added a diversity team in the admissions office, expanded outreach around the state, and made other changes.
We created the Berkeley in Espanol website. For me, it was important that we had materials that were in a language that parents could absorb, that they were comfortable with so they could engage in that conversation.
Every year, Berkeley brings to campus high school college counselors and college advisors from around the state. Ogundele says these connections are increasingly important as the university tries to reach more underrepresented students.
A lot of times people think that the admissions work at Berkeley is, you know, the really strong students versus the really weak students, and you just kind of make decisions. But really, a majority of our applicant pool is strong enough to get in here. So let's have a conversation about what are some of those deeper nuances that we need to really consider to really make sure that excellence emerges in the conversation.
The changes are showing results. This year's freshman enrollment for underrepresented groups was about 24%, up from 17% in 2017.
I think we are all going to be learning from the University of California system.
Angel Perez says the approach Ogundele and his colleagues are taking at Berkeley could be helpful for schools around the country if the Supreme Court overturns affirmative action. He's the CEO of the National Association for College Admission Counseling, which represents more than 25,000 admission and counseling professionals.
They are actually some of the pioneers in creating more partnership programs in local communities, partnering with high schools or community-based organizations, and creating programs where students can begin to do work before they actually become high school seniors so that they become eligible for the requirements for admission to get into the UC. And so they've been really intentional there, and they actually have had some pretty good success.
Berkeley is also focusing more attention on minority students' on-campus experiences.
This year I have classes where I'm the only black student. Even the classes that are within the African American Studies Department, you'll see a handful of black identifying students.
Shaka Talem, a senior majoring in political economy, is student body president, the first in school history to be elected twice. He says there's been progress, but problems remain.
Unfortunately, it is a common phenomenon, especially among the black community, to not really have this sense of belonging. And I think that really everyone, I would argue, that walks through here at some point in time will feel a sense of imposter syndrome, right? And imposter syndrome meaning the doubt that one has on whether or not they actually belong in an environment. And I think that when you're the only one in certain classrooms, that's exacerbated three times over. It's gonna be much more harder for you to actually reap the benefits and fully like embrace the wonderful things that Berkeley has to offer.
Ogundele, Berkeley's head of admission, says it's more difficult to achieve diversity without being able to consider race and ethnicity when choosing students.
I'm really grateful for the gains that we've had. We have not returned back to pre-Prop 209 numbers. Take a look at the millions of dollars that the UC has spent, as well as Berkeley has spent over the last 30 years to try to get the diversity numbers. When you look at what our data looked like back when we could consider those factors, we were much more in line with the high school graduating population in regards to diversity versus acceptances and enrollments into Cal. If you ask me if I think that we could do better work with the ability to consider those factors, the answer to that is absolutely.
An ability schools around the country could lose after the Supreme Court's ruling, which could come during the process for admitting the class of 2027. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang in Berkeley, California.
A year-long independent investigation into the U.S. National Women's Soccer League found systemic patterns of emotional abuse and sexual misconduct, and that the league, as well as the U.S. Soccer Federation, failed to address players' complaints for years. Amna Nawaz has our report.
Judy, the report documents allegations of verbal and sexual abuse across multiple teams, shows how players' complaints were dismissed by league officials, and lays out in disturbing detail the misconduct of three past coaches. According to the report, former Racing Louisville coach Christy Holly used his power to sexually abuse and retaliate against his players. Paul Riley, former coach of the North Carolina Courage, coerced players to have sex with him, and his abuse was a so-called open secret. And Chicago Red Stars former coach Rory Dames was known for his tirades and, quote, crossed the line into sexual relationships with his former youth league players. The investigation was led by former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, who joins me now. Ms. Yates, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thank you for joining us. I want to ask you about how you chose to begin your report, because you begin with a story, and it's the story of current player Erin Simon and her April 2021 account of when she was abused by her then coach, Christy Holly. Tell me why you chose to begin with that particular story.
Well, as we were investigating this and we saw just how prevalent the instances of abuse were, we thought it was going to be really important to actually tell this as a story, for it not to be at a 10,000 foot level where you're giving an overview and people can look away. It seemed really important for everyone to have to look up close and personal at the individuals, at the women who suffered in this instance.
The abuse you find in your report was systemic. You also say it was inevitable. What did you mean by that?
Well, the league, the NWSL, was founded after two prior leagues had failed. And there were issues with abuse and misconduct in the prior leagues. In fact, many say that one such incident was a big cause of the failure of the predecessor league. So against that backdrop, the very idea that it was set up without any basic protections in place is just crazy. And not just for the first year, but it went on year after year.
We have to point out
in some instances.
I apologize. Go ahead.
No, I said in some instances, I would say, what did they expect to happen without having set up those protections?
We should point out in each of these cases, with each of these coaches, players complained. They went to league officials. They went to the league commissioner in one case. What did you find in your investigation about how the league and how U.S. Soccer Federation responded?
Yeah, and that was one of the most disturbing things. You know, after this first came out, I heard people saying, well, the player should have complained. Well, they did complain in various ways, through player surveys, through going to team ownership, going to the league, going to the federation. And those complaints were generally either ignored completely, or sometimes there were some individuals, particularly owners, who would ascribe bad motives to the players for making those complaints instead.
You know, you conducted over 200 interviews for this, and that includes over 100 former and current players. How many of those players had experienced some kind of abuse?
You know, I'll confess I haven't gone back and you know, tallied it up. But most of the players we spoke with either had witnessed or experienced it personally themselves, and in varying levels. I'm certainly not suggesting here that every player was abused or that every coach is abusive. But this climate, this environment was familiar to most of the players.
Three of the players that you name in the report who did come forward with abuse complaints, Sinead Farrelly and Mana Shim and Erin Simon, issued this statement yesterday after your report. And in part of it, they say, quote, no one involved has taken any responsibility for the clear role they played in harming players. They are calling for accountability and change. And they also say, Ms. Yates, they say they want owners who've been complicit to be removed. What do you make of that?
Well, look, I certainly understand this. Everyone, I think, is interested and anxious to move forward. But I don't think that it's very realistic to think that anyone or the players can move forward without there being some measure of accountability for what's happened in the past. And accountability begins first with taking responsibility for one's actions. And so I think that's basic human nature, and that's what the players are asking for.
I also have to ask that you mention youth soccer and youth leagues several times. These coaches who are named in here all had ties to youth soccer leagues. You also say your investigation was just focused on the professional league. You didn't pursue information that came up related to youth leagues, but millions of parents are going to read that, and they're going to be worried. So what should they know about what you found about what's going on in youth soccer leagues?
Yeah, our investigation was of the NWSL, of women's professional soccer, but player after player told us about their experiences in youth soccer. And again, you know, there's a range of conduct here in the abuse, but one of the really common threads we heard was that these young players got used to being verbally abused by their coaches. And frankly, some of the parents, I think, got used to that as well. And there were also very gray lines in the relationships between players and coaches. You know, I think that we all need to wake up and step up and look at what is going on in our youth leagues and take control of that.
That is former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates joining us today with this report on the National Women's Soccer League. Thank you so much, Ms. Yates.
Thanks for having me.
Loretta Lynn was the original coal miner's daughter, a title taken from her hit song. The legendary country singer died today at the age of 90, leaving a legacy of more than six decades of boundary-breaking music. In 2019, several generations of Nashville stars came out for a concert celebrating Lynn's birthday. Jeffrey Brown was there, and he spoke with her about her life and career, beginning with her humble roots in a tiny coal mining community in Kentucky. Here's an excerpt. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
This is my first birthday party I ever had.
Oh, really?
And when I was a little girl, Mommy would say, well, today you're 5 years old. Next time, today you're six. I never had a birthday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now you deserve it, I guess.
Well, I'm loving it.
What was the ambition back then?
You know, you never dared dream big because where have you been to dream? I mean, how could you dream when you've never seen nothing or never been nowhere? Never been to town, I'd never been to town, so you didn't dare dream.
But now I'm a honky-tonk girl.
Her first hit, I'm a Honky-Tonk Girl, came in 1960 and set her on a trailblazing path. First woman in country music to write a number one hit song, You Ain't Woman Enough to Take My Man.
Loretta Lynn.
First to be named Country Music Association Entertainer of the Year, and to have more than 50 top 10 country hits.
What's the key to writing a good song? What does it have to have?
It's got to have the person.
The person meaning you?
It's got to have the heart and soul of a person that's writing it.
That sounds simple, but it can't be simple to capture the real person.
It's not simple because it's hard on the writer. I used to lock myself up to, you know, shut myself in a room before I would get through with a song. I wouldn't come out till I got it wrote.
And when did you know that you had it, that it was done?
Well, I would know when I had it done. If you don't know when you have it done, you shouldn't be writing.
Yeah.
Oh, but I don't think you can.
She was a strong voice for women in a conservative industry. A powerhouse in a business run by men, making herself a multimillionaire.
You know, we all know you as a great artist, but I understand you've always been a great businesswoman as well. Was that
pretty good?
You took care of things, and
yeah, yes, I did.
Because you had to? Did you have to learn how to do that?
If you're hungry, yeah, you learn how to make a living if you're hungry.
So what's been the key to surviving and thriving for so long in this business?
You have to be smart. Hard work and smart. Mm-hmm. That's all it takes. If you got a little talent, you can go a long way if you're smart and put the work in it.
Not much left on the floor. Nothing lives here anymore except the memories of a coal miner's daughter.
What an icon, Loretta Lynn. Thank you, Jeffrey Brown. And premiering tomorrow on PBS, the NewsHour's own William Brangham hosts a special report on the wider, often unseen impacts of gun violence in America.
That gun took everything from me.
Gun violence is plaguing this country.
Some guy with an AR-15 just murdered my daughter.
My mom called and said David shot himself.
But what about the trauma that lingers?
I don't go to bed any night that I don't think of her being blown apart.
This is not something that you come out of unchanged.
Ricochet, an American trauma, October 5th at 10, 9 Central.
That is tomorrow night on PBS. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.